I found the captured insect in my test tube only once, but it wasn't the adult ichneumon with white rings on its feelers, but its chrysalis, i.e. its earlier stage. It was alive, and it moved its belly when touched, but, much to my dismay, it has died a week later. Before he takes off, he is in our space-time. When he lands, he fully returns to space-time once more, only now he has traveled in time. When he tried to bring insects back, they often didn't make it, but in the case of the ichneumon, he actually saw the adult body revert back to its larval stage in the tube. According to the New Energy Technologies article, Dr. Grebennikov sent a patent application to Russia with Professor V. Zolotarev for this stunning invention. He got nothing but resistance from the scientific community. A Russian newspaper published a pre-release of Grebennikov's book about his invention in 1992, complete with a photograph allegedly showing him levitating about 2 or 3 feet off the ground on his platform. There are also a variety of close-up photographs of the platform itself. A Russian magazine, Technika Molodezhi, also published the photographs and mentioned that he had publicly demonstrated the device at the Siberian Research Institute of Agriculture and Agricultural Chemistry. His book was originally going to be 500 pages with 400 color images, and the original newspaper article said he would give all the precise details of exactly how to build his device. He was then told by his publishers and editor that it was forbidden to publish this information, clearly suggesting they were warned by the Russian government not to release the data for matters of national security. Two photos of Grebennikov in flight were left in the book since they had already leaked, but the page count dropped to just over 300, and he had to rewrite the entire manuscript. Gordon Novell, who claims to have had access to classified technologies, also reported the connection between gravity shielding and time travel in an interview with Carrie Cassidy of Project Camelot. A UFO is probably very much like the cars back in Back to the Future, a flying time machine. They're capable of going backwards and forwards in time. To negate gravity, you've got to negate time. So time is the power of the bird. We don't believe its power comes from space or zero point. We believe it comes from time, purely and simply, and that energy and time are the same thing. Tesla technology. Nikola Tesla also allegedly developed a working gravity shielding technology, and he may have even had some help. Sidney Kirkpatrick was the first person allowed full access to the KC archives, including all the original names, and that's how we now know that Nikola Tesla and Thomas Edison both had professional interaction with Edgar Cayce from 1905 to 1907. This almost certainly meant Tesla had at least one reading. Later, a series of Cayce readings were done that went into extreme technical detail with an inventor who was working on a gravity-shielding prototype called the no-fuel motor. Specifically, in reading 195-54, question 13, Cayce's source says that gravity is the result of two forces, one going down and one going back up. It also explains that this is a fairly crude way to explain it, because there is an ongoing amount of circular, spiraling vortex movement occurring in both directions as well. Unfortunately, two separate fires at Cayce's photography studio destroyed all the records from Cayce's early years, including any readings he may have done for Tesla. Additional correspondence between Tesla, Thomas Edison, and Cayce was also later destroyed by a well-meaning but short-sighted volunteer at the Edgar Cayce Archive in Virginia Beach. Regardless of whether Tesla had any help from Cayce, just 4 years after they began corresponding with each other, Tesla made some provocative statements in an interview with the New York Herald. "The flying machine of the future, my flying machine, will be heavier than air, but it will not be an aeroplane. It will have no wings, Yet it will be able to move at will through the air in any direction with perfect safety, and at higher speeds than have yet been reached. It can remain absolutely stationary in the air, even in a wind, for great lengths of time. Its lifting power will not depend upon any such delicate devices as the bird has to employ, but upon positive, mechanical action. When asked by the Herald journalist to clarify what he meant by mechanical action, Tesla said, "Through gyroscopic action of my engine, assisted by some devices I am not yet prepared to talk about, my airship will have neither gas bag, wings, nor propellers." In Lost Science, Jerry Vassilatos gives testimony from alleged eyewitnesses to Tesla actually using this technology. Tesla was seen standing on a platform, surrounded by a purplish corona some 30 feet above the ground. The contrivance had a small coil on top and was entirely covered underneath with the smooth surface of sheet copper. The platform was perhaps 2 feet in total depth, being crammed with components. Tesla strode over to the platform, stood before a control panel, and whisked aloft in a crown of white sparks. The excessive sparks subsided with increased distance from the ground, often arcing to metal fencing. Tesla went out of his way to avoid the numerous metallic ranch fencing beneath his aerial course. It was said that Tesla often delighted in soaring through the night air for hours each night. Ralph Ring, Otis Carr, and Tesla's Utron. In August 2006, Project Camelot interviewed Ralph Ring, a 71-year-old technician who worked with Otis T. Carr, inventor of the Otis elevator system, in the late 1950s and early 1960s. Carr had studied under Nikola Tesla and was allegedly given the secret to his gravity shielding technology. Carr finished developing a working saucer-shaped craft in 1947 and built a number of them, but initially it did not generate any official interest. In 2006, Ralph Ring finally came forward with an impressive barrage of technical documents, including detailed blueprints from Carr's OTC Enterprises company. Major Wayne Aho, a former Army Combat Intelligence Officer during World War II, announced that he would take the craft to the moon on December 7, 1959, that the trip would take 5 hours, and that he would remain in orbit for 7 days before returning. The 45-foot diameter craft he was to use weighed 30 tons and was powered by the Utron engine. The Utron engine was obviously Tesla's invention, and there was a key emphasis placed on the fact that it was round from the top-down view and a perfect square from the side view. This caused it to be shaped like a top or two cones connected base to base. Ring did not gain any financial benefits from coming forward, and he had clear and extensive documentation, including photographs of Carr with the device and detailed technical blueprints he obviously would not have spent money faking. When you read what Ring actually says, the case becomes very compelling. First of all, we see solid metal becoming flexible, in this case, like jello. When recalling the heady events of the late 1950s working day and night with Carr, Ring again and again stressed that the key was working with nature. Resonance, he would emphasize repeatedly. You have to work with nature, not against her. He described how, when the model discs were powered up and reached a particular rotational speed, the metal turned to jello. You could push your finger right into it. It ceased to be solid. It turned into another form of matter, which was as if it was not entirely here in this reality. It was uncanny, one of the weirdest sensations I've ever felt. The craft also traveled through time while also traveling through space. Did the craft fly? Fly is not the right word. It traversed distance. It seemed to take no time. I was with two other engineers when we piloted the 45-foot craft about 10 miles. I thought it hadn't moved, I thought it had failed. I was completely astonished when we realized that we had returned with samples of rocks and plants from our destination. It was a dramatic success. It was more like a kind of teleportation. What's more, time was distorted somehow. We felt we were in the craft about 15 or 20 minutes. We were told afterwards that we'd been carefully timed as having been in the craft no longer than 3 or 4 minutes. Perhaps even more interesting is the direct conscious interaction that took place with the source field in this process. The utron was the key to it all. Carr said it accumulated energy because of its shape and focused it, and also responded to our conscious intentions. When we operated the machine, we didn't work any controls. We went into a kind of meditative state, and all three of us focused our intentions on the effect we wanted to achieve. It sounds ridiculous, I know, but that's what we did, and that's what worked. Carr had tapped into some principle which is not understood, in which consciousness melds with engineering to create an effect. You can't write that into equations. I have no idea how he knew it would work, but it did. Carr told everyone to stuff their pockets with rocks, clumps of dirt, and grass from their destination. Otherwise, when they returned, they wouldn't have any conscious memory of going anywhere and would think the whole thing was a failure, not unlike Baxter's roommate waking up from hypnosis and thinking nothing had happened. Sure enough, when Ring came back from the trip, he remembered nothing, but his pockets were stuffed with grass. He was absolutely stunned and only later remembered the trip as if waking up from a dream. When he asked Carr how it worked, this is what he said. Your brain is there to operate your body. You're in a vessel here. It's an illusionary vessel that people don't realize because we're creating it in microseconds. From 1 second to the other, these shutters are opening and shutting, creating all this reality you see around you. But it doesn't really exist. It's all spirit. It's all energy. But we're creating it. People don't realize that man, in a sense, created time. Time doesn't exist, in essence. It does when we create it, and we have a beginning and an end to something. We call that time. But in a greater reality, there is no time. The shutters opening and closing sounds just like the fluctuations in physical, chemical, biological, and radioactive reactions that Schnoll discovered are happening all over the world. Unfortunately, agents working within classified projects swooped in on Carr in 1961, and they wouldn't take no for an answer. They came over with all their bells and whistles and said, "You're shutting down right now." And we asked them why, and they said, "Because of your threat to overthrow the monetary system of the United States of America." That was their ploy. And were confiscating everything. They went into the offices and they went into the lab and they started just confiscating everything. Then they debriefed us and told us, in essence, "You guys are wrong. You're attempting to overthrow the monetary system." This secrecy has gone on for quite some time, a cosmic Watergate, as Dr. Stanton Friedman referred to it in an article that circulated through mainstream media while I was writing this book. This may be an outgrowth of the same secrecy the Founding Fathers kept around the meaning of the Great Seal of the United States, putting a message out there for those who would bother to find it, but never explaining it in any direct, open way. I hope it has become clear by now that there is an obvious, uniform system of principles behind these technologies. Once we fix the mistakes we've made in science, we can explain all the observations and realize how these same forces already appear in nature. Right for now, no one has made a definite breakthrough with a technology like this that has gone mainstream, though similar discoveries were made by Thomas Townsend Brown, the Beefeld Brown effect, Professor John Searle, the Searle levity disk, and others. Brown decided to cooperate with the security apparatus and his work became classified, whereas Searle fought against it and was ruined. But their results are also consistent with everything we've been discussing here. Two Russian scientists, Roshan and Godin, independently rebuilt Searle's technology and got a very strong lift, though their device had to be bolted to the laboratory table for safety. Searle and his associates have recently released videos online showing his unique turbine in action, which skeptics previously attacked him about and had said was impossible. Searle's team is allegedly working to develop a fully operational prototype of their device, as is Ralph Ring. Do it yourself with lung gum. At the time I write this book, none of us have open access to these technologies. But perhaps this shift into the golden age represents a time where we won't need them. Is it possible to generate enough coherence that you could actually levitate your own body without any technology at all? The Tibetans appear to have inherited the secrets to this amazing trick as well. The technique is called lung gum, and it was witnessed by Alexandra David Neal and written up in her 1931 classic, With Mystics and Magicians in Tibet. In this case, the monks are able to go into a deep trance state where they can run along in huge leaps at a remarkably fast speed, using their bodies in a way that completely defies gravity as we now understand it. Lung gum may have originally been used to travel vast distances much more quickly than walking or riding a yak. Each time one of their feet hits the ground, they launch off again in another huge leap. Though this may be an exaggeration from one too many movies, each leap may lead to them traveling as much as 30 feet high and 100 feet forward, if not more. David Neal had heard stories about this practice, but finally one day she witnessed it happening at a distance through binoculars. Her Tibetan traveling partners could see the image of the monk with their naked eye and confirmed that it was indeed a lung gum pa, a monk skilled in this fascinating art. She wanted to go to the man, witness it up close, and ask him questions, but she was sternly warned. Your reverence will not stop the Lama, nor speak to him. This would certainly kill him. These Lamas, when traveling, must not break their meditation. The God who is in them escapes if they cease to repeat the nagags, mantras, and when thus leaving them before the proper time, he shakes them so hard that they die. To me, this sounds like a mythical legend that was created to explain something we now can understand scientifically. Based on these new laws of physics we are now rediscovering, we can assume that in order for the monk to accomplish the practice of lung gum, he would have to be able to bring roughly half the atoms and molecules in his body into time-space. He would then be half in, half out. How exactly did they learn this practice? Does this require some sort of pineal gland awakening process? That may be part of it. David Neal explained that in order to train for this ability, you must first spend several years practicing various types of breathing exercises. Eventually, your teacher gives you a mantra that you repeat in a rhythmic fashion. Your breathing and your footsteps all have to keep time with the syllables of the mantra while you do the practice. To me, there is a remarkable amount of data in this report that is consistent with what we have been learning so far, which David Neal obviously had no idea about at the time. Heat disrupts the coherence in the source field, and during the hottest times of day, lung gum doesn't work very well. Also, the shape of an area determines the structure of the source field, just like the pyramid effect. So uneven ground, narrow valleys, and trees all create influences that can disrupt the path of a lung gum pa, whereas flatland and wide desert spaces make it much easier. And lastly, your normal state of mind shifts into a deep trance, where most of your awareness is no longer here in space-time. Your pineal gland is probably quite active, as most of your awareness has now transferred over into your astral body or energetic duplicate in time-space, as Gadeyev and others have shown in the DNA fandom. Interestingly, David Neal also reports that if the monks did this practice too often, they could become stuck in a halfway point and then actually have to weigh themselves down with chains in order to be able to stay on the ground. Although there are many well-documented cases of human levitation that could not have been faked, including Christian saints, yogis, and the exceptional abilities of Daniel Douglas Home in the 1800s, witnessed by scientists, scholars, governmental figures, and other luminaries, one story of levitation in Dr. Claude Swanson's The Synchronized Universe stood out to me. This involves Peter Sugleris, a young Greek boy in the 1980s who could move objects, bend spoons, and other metal utensils without even touching them, as witnessed by many people. These spoon-bending feats can now be explained by the atoms flipping over into time-space, so the material actually starts to be bendable. And yes, Sugleris was also able to levitate. In 1986, his wife photographed him as he hovered 18 inches off the kitchen floor and stayed up there for 47 seconds. The exertion appeared on his face as a frightening grimace, and he broke out in a cold sweat and was exhausted afterward. It took him 10 or 15 seconds to regain normal consciousness. In order to do it, he required immense concentration and a purification vegetarian diet for several weeks before the event.